Persephone will tell her mother, who then will blab to all the others. My brother Zeus and all the gods above, and they'll all think that I'm a weenie. There'll be no end to all their teasing. And then for all eternity, I'll have to listen while Persephone goes on about the power of love.
Good afternoon. You are listening to WERA LP Arlington at 96.7 on your FM dial or online at WERA.FM. I am Janet Copenhaver, your host for the next 30 minutes on the Embracing Arlington Arts radio show. So I certainly wanted to wish everyone a happy spring, but I don't think Mother Nature quite got the memo. So stay safe during our storm and stay inside, make a fire. And while you're stuck inside, it would be a good idea to get out your computer and send a letter to the county board in support of Arlington Independent Media. I know a lot of you have heard that they face a potential 20% cut in their operating costs based on a budget recommended by the county manager. And we need folks to weigh in, anyone who listens, participates, volunteers, or just enjoys community television and radio should get involved. There's a ton of information at the website at arlingtonindependentmedia.org. It takes about 20 seconds to get a letter sent in, and we really do need your help to reverse this potential devastating, really, really devastating cut to their budget. So please check it out and weigh in while you're staying inside out of the storm. So today's show, we have probably our first playwright. Yeah, I think it's been our first playwright we've ever had. We're going to be probing your mind a little bit about going through that journey of how a story starts as an idea and then getting it seen and performed on the stage. So let me welcome Richard Washer. He is a playwright, as I mentioned, and the Associate Artistic Director at the Rose Theater. So welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess before we delve into you as a playwright, we kind of have a two-pronged approach to our show today. But I wanted to talk first about the evolution of what is now the Rose Theater, but it's gone through several different iterations, and I think each time gets more expansive and
seems to grow.
Yeah, it's growing more and more.
Everything grows.
And I know you've been involved since the very beginning, so why don't you kind of walk us through what's been going on with that organization over the last 20 years or so?
Sure. At the beginning was Charter Theater, which was a company I had co-founded way back in the late 1990s. And around 2008, we started to fade out as a company. Growing families, bad economy, all these things kind of contributed to a lot of theater companies hit that 10-year point and they kind of fold. And however, we had a program which was part of my job at Charter Theater was doing a reading series. And we were very lucky that a young woman by the name of Leslie Kobolinski came along and loved what we were doing with the reading series. And she asked if she could just continue that. And so she began it as First Draft at Charter Theater and started that program and then gradually started separating the program. She did a brilliant job of bringing audiences in and creating a program that started off very small from what we had started. And it has evolved since then from around 2008 or 9. And in those interim years and in the years since, we've probably done 50 or more readings of new plays by playwrights, local as well as somewhat regional. And it came out, it just kind of grew out of that and continues to grow.
Right. And now as Rose Theater.
Right.
You do more than the goal or the mission is to expand.
It's still kind of formulating and changing. But yes, so First Draft became that. Leslie's vision is far grander than that in the sense that she has Rose Theater Company, which First Draft is a component of. And so we are looking at different kinds of programs. And First Draft, what's confusing, I think, to some people is we started as First Draft, but that is now a component under the umbrella of Rose Theater company, and we're looking at other kinds of programs, which I think we'll probably talk about during the course of this time.
Yeah, and something we didn't talk about when we were chatting last week. So First Draft does, I think there's five different plays each year, roughly.
Between three and five, yeah.
So how do you get those plays? Do playwrights send them in to you, or do you actively go out and get them, or commission them, or all of the above?
Pretty much a combination. Yes, some of it is we turn to playwrights that we know. We really are attracted to writers who are interested in the process and want to do the work of looking at their work, not just writing the play, but rewriting the play. You hear writers talk about that all the time. Writing is very little of it is just the inspiration of putting it down on paper. The real work goes into the 80% of the rewrites. And
that's probably the hard part, right? How to cut things
out. Yeah, it depends. It depends on who you talk to. Some people love that, and others are like, ugh, you know, I hate that part of it. We try to find those that love that aspect of it. But we will reach out to other writers. I teach playwriting up in Bethesda, and so occasionally I come across writers, too, that as they evolve and as they're working, I might try to recommend that they be part of the program. Others come along, they submit their scripts or they see what we're doing. And, if the one thing that we tell writers is if they are interested, we encourage them to come to our readings to get a sense of what our aesthetic is. Not that we have a particular kind of play we do, but we have a particular kind of process. And we want that to be kind of clear to the writer.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there a theme for your three to five, like, hey, our theme is, pick up politics, Then do you say to these playwrights, oh, we need a play about politics, or it's just whatever?
It actually works more, often it works in the reverse. We may have a series of plays, and we may look at them and say, oh, okay, we'll pluck these for the series because they fall into a thing. As an example, a few years ago, Leslie had, I forget how she called it, but it was essentially plays that were in a second draft form. So they weren't the first draft. And they were an opportunity for a writer to kind of get at it and try it again. And actually, the play that I have coming up is a rewrite from a couple of years ago.
Okay. But we are going to get to that. Mm-hmm. Kind of a nice segue into you as a playwright. How did you know you had the gift to think that you wanted to pursue a career in playwriting, and just how did you evolve?
From pure hubris. I was in college. I went to University of Virginia, and I remember taking a playwriting class, and we were invited to read. We were told to read a series of plays, and one of them was Edward Albee's A Zoo Story. And then the professor, true or false, I don't really know. I've never really investigated, but he claimed that, Albee wrote that when he was 30, and he just wrote it really quickly, just came out of him. And I looked at that play and thought, I can do that. And I've been trying ever since.
Not so easy.
But, you're 20, and you look at that, and you say, yeah, okay, how hard can that be?
Right. So you mentioned UVA. Are you a basketball fan?
Oh, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, moving on. It was all over the news, though.
Oh, just slightly. Yeah, well, we could have a whole 30-minute conversation about that.
All right, let's go back to your plays then. So you mentioned that some, it can flow for some people, and others it takes months and months and months. So walk us through kind of how does that happen for you? How do you come up with an idea? And I think I told you I was going to ask you this question. How do you know when it's done?
I think let's approach that one first. How do you know it's done? What I had to wrap my brain around as a young playwright was that there is no such thing as a perfect play. And you have to accept that. And I imagine that's probably true of any artist. This vision, this idea, this thing that's percolating in your head is pure genius, and it's wonderful until you put it on the paper, and then you have to start compromising with your work. And probably, I don't have children, but probably not unlike having children, it's sort of like it's a lifetime of compromises, of saying, okay, I see you being this. Yeah, well, I am this. Well, okay, well, maybe you could do this.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, okay. That's what I've heard. So, so that, in my experience, has been trying to say, okay, at some point, you just have to let go. You have, you know, you could, I can twiddle, I can tweak forever and ever, but the real key for me when something is done is when I have something of an organic, cohesive unit together, something that's ending speaks to the beginning and the beginning speaks to the end. And that may sound kind of simple, but that's actually the hardest part to do. I can't count the number of plays, including my own, where I get to the end of the first act and things are just hopping along and I'm just, okay, this is great. And then the second act is just, because your choices just become less and less as you go
on.
That's
very true.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like journalism in some ways where you're starting with a thesis and you kind of, you know, have that on the wall that you can look at and keep yourself on track. Part of the goal is finding that thesis. That's when I know I'm on the right track, is when I finally have something that says, okay, here's the beginning and here's the end, and I need to figure out how we get there.
And you know what the beginning and the end is before you start writing?
No.
You know what the beginning is?
I often start with that, mm-hmm. For better or for worse. In my playwriting workshops, I tell new playwrights that there's a hard way of writing plays and then there's a harder way. And I unfortunately fall in that latter category where I start with this. I kind of go with an inspiration. I tend to be intuitive. And then the challenge is holding on to that intuition and following it to the end and not scaling back and becoming more of a journalist about it and saying, okay, this is what I want you to be. Again, it's raising kids.
Exactly. And then you find most of your ideas are through your experiences, life experiences, or is it total fiction, or are you looking at the clouds? Or
Yeah. Oh, I'm good at that. It's a mix. I think it's very difficult. When I look back over a play, it's never conscious, but when I look back over something, inevitably something of my own experience has been woven into that somehow. Now, whether that's something, I rarely do I set out and say I'm going to tell that story. It's usually something that I've either observed and it's stayed in my head somehow, or it's something that I've experienced. A play I've got called Quartet is very much about my own experience of visiting a friend in Nova Scotia and the weekend that I spent up there. And interestingly enough, I got on the plane to fly home and I had this notion of, said, this is what it must feel like to know you're pregnant. I mean, this is going to be a play. I had no control. This is going, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be.
So, so now kind of moving into where first draft comes in. So you've gone through this. It's either a quick write or years of writing. and you say done. Then there's a kind of a long journey to actually see it on stage. So kind of you kind of hinted at it before, but how do these play readings work like at a first draft?
Well, things have changed in 50 or 60 years, especially since the 60s. The old model used to be, Neil Simon would write a play and he would put the end on it. And then he'd take it to a producer and say, yay, let's do it. And then they would take it out of town and they'd try it out on different audiences and he would tweak. So actually a bit misleading to say it's actually even done at the stage that you finish a draft. So what I have learned over the years is that is actually the, getting that first draft done is one stage, but I often don't know enough about my own story and my own characters even at that time. To be able to, I probably should more than I do, but one of the wonderful things about a reading series, like we do at First Draft, is that you bring your material there in front of an audience, and that audience, then the way that they respond in various ways, which we can talk about, really informs that writing process. So it continues to change. It continues to grow. And I've changed directions and from because of that. So, but getting back to your question, so you get a draft done, and I try not to write the end at the end because I know it's not the end. It's probably just the beginning. And then coming to some place like First Draft is it's marvelous because you, we bring in some really we rely on actors who we know are really facile with new work or quick. They get one rehearsal and they read through it quickly. We discuss it. We do it. And then they go home and everybody forgets about it for 24 hours or 48. What depends when the rehearsal is. And we come back and read it. My own experience and what I try to encourage other writers to do is sit at the back of the audience and watch the audience watch the play.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that. You can tell.
Oh, God, yes. For better or for worse.
I remember I saw a show, Night Mother, which...
Oh, yeah.
And the director and was at the back of the room, and he said they didn't move until, like, there was one funny line, and then he... Yeah. So you learn a lot from the back of the heads, too.
Sure.
As well as the talking heads.
Especially the heads that start to nod down further and further, or the coughs that come along, or when laughters come. And sometimes it comes when you planned it, and which is such a wonderful feeling, and sometimes it comes when you didn't plan it, which causes you to change your script sometimes.
I would imagine, right.
Which it maybe should or shouldn't, who knows. So we go through it. We also, very important to the process, is we engage the audience in a conversation after the reading. And that's really critical. That part, and I say it's critical less as a writer and more as an associate director at the Rose Theater, because what it does is it engages our audiences in a way that I think there's a new audience out there now that didn't used to be there. The way that we look for entertainment today has really changed over the last 20, 30 years with media explosion of all sorts. And so we as Rose Theater Company are really looking at how do we understand that and how do we intersect with that new audience. And this is one of many ways. And that is there's so much opportunity for creativity today that there wasn't before. You've got a phone, so non-trained musicians suddenly can do music. Or somebody can actually make a little movie using your phone, much less other cameras. Mm-hmm. And it's marvelous. That's creating this beautiful energy of creativity. And so our audiences are coming to it hungry to be creative, too. We all have that hunger inside us. So from our perspective, when we engage that conversation, there's a creativity going there. They're not writing the play, or they're not saying, oh, fix it this way, but they are part of that creative process by mm-hmm. saying, oh, I felt this, or I saw that there, or it reminded me of my grandmother, or whatever
is
reactions. And every single one of those is helpful to the writer. It could either be, oh, that reminded me of this, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, I had no intention, or, oh, wow, that's cool.
Right, I've gone to several of them, and I could just sit back and listen to the feedback.
Comments.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. It's people pick up so many different things.
Oh, yeah.
And I've heard great suggestions of how to change it. And,
sure.
So you do have, or our listeners have an opportunity to actually participate. You have a show, a reading that's going to be March 27th in D.C. and 28th in Virginia.
Right.
And that is Persephone?
Persephone and Burlesque.
And Burlesque. So we had an audio clip. Well, why don't you tell us about the show first, and then we'll play the audio clip, because you do have an original score with this.
Right.
So what's the play about, and then we'll go over to the clip.
Okay. And here's another great example of something growing out of control. I was commissioned to write this, a one act by the National Conservatory of Dramatic Arts, and it needed to have a lot of characters, so I turned to Greek mythology and I wrote a one act, in that time about Eurydice and Orpheus. And then subsequently found out I was one of about 400,000 writers and musicians and others out there who have done the same thing. There's something about that myth that just draws people to it. I think I mentioned we did a Kennedy Center reading of it in 2015 with First Draft, which turned it into a bigger piece, and we added elements of music. And the response I got from the audience was, the music was wonderful. We just want more of it. And so, oh, you want a musical. So that's a great example. Oh, God.
Hadn't planned
on
that.
It was a one act. Now it's a full-blown musical. So it's based on, the shift is that it's the Eurydice-Orpheus myth, which is Eurydice dying and Orpheus coming down to bring her back from death to live. Mm-hmm. And but it's from the point of view of Persephone. And it's just a different look at it's a pure fantasy of how this might have happened. Because I have so many questions about that myth, about Eurydice and Orpheus, of why different things happen. And Greek myths are so wonderful about that, they don't answer those questions. You know, they just present these stories and you mm-hmm. are left scratching your head. And so it's essentially about Persephone trying to convince her husband that love is more powerful than death, largely because she feels a bit neglected after a number of years of marriage to him. And he's not the most romantic out there. One wouldn't picture the king of Hades being that romantic. he doesn't disappoint. And she goes out to do that. And doing that, she knows that Orpheus would come down, and she leads him down to try to bring her back, and things unfold from there.
Well, I think this will be because I'm going to go, obviously, to go see it. And I think it's the first time I've ever seen a play reading with an original score. So let's hear that clip, and then you can tell us about the person who wrote it and where it is in the play.
Great.
Thanks.
If they walk out of here together, Persephone will tell her mother, who then will blab to all the others. My brother Zeus and all the gods above, and they'll all think that I'm a weenie. There'll be no end to all their teasing. And then for all eternity, I'll have to listen while Persephone goes on about the power of love. You know, I'm really not a bad guy. I'm kind to animals and children. I treat our guests here with the utmost decorum, so they can quietly enjoy their dismal fate. But this malarkey about romance and love's alleged transcendent power, these are infernal, noxious lies, and they will be legitimized if Eurydice and Orpheus can just walk out that gate. You know, I've nothing against love poems. I dabbled in the arts myself once when I was young. I started out an English major. And it was poetry that helped me win my love. But in the end, love's overrated. And our community is gated. She's not leaving, he's not staying. Rules are rules, I'm not okaying. Special treatment so Persephone can try to make a fool of me. She'd embarrass me to prove her point, but I'm the one who runs this joint, and I decide who's alive and who is dead. We need a plan. We need a plan.
All right. Well, now I'm really looking forward to this. This is going to be hilarious.
Hopefully it'll be fun.
That's right. So the person who wrote the musical score. Right.
Mark Haig. Mm-hmm. Last name is H-A-A-G. He is a Silver Spring resident, and he is a composer, obviously. He did the lyrics and the music for this piece. And what a great sport, because the script, it was not something we created the story together. So essentially, I had all of this molded together, and he came along and said, okay, I'll find ways of fitting music in. And you know, some of it's give and take in that, and changes were made. Mark's background, to the extent that I know it, is he is a, he writes for film. He writes underscoring for film, and as well as like incidental music for theater in the past. I think this is the first musical that he's done. I'm not positive about that. But he's clearly a lot of experience writing music, wonderful studio in his basement where we've worked. I'm very jealous of.
So what's going on in the play when this
is the top of the second act, without giving away too much. The end of the first act comes as a bit of a surprise for Persephone. And however, Hades quickly realizes that he cannot allow Eurydice to leave because then he will lose this bet that they've set up that love is greater than... He will need to then admit that love is greater than death. And so he is determined to figure that part out. So thus, we need a plan. And he's with Charon, who is the individual who takes everybody across the River Styx when they die. Usually a hooded figure with a cane and very dark. In this particular case, he's an Australian, and he is kind of trying to keep up with everybody and not doing a good job of it.
So most importantly, where we said it was March 28th in Arlington, where can people go see it and find out more information?
Let's see. The Arts Club of Washington on the 27th, is a Tuesday, mm-hmm. is there on I Street, right across from GW University, in the old Monroe building. Very cool, amazing building. And then Wednesday night, the 28th, is at Theater on the Run in Shirlington and in Arlington. If you go to rosetheater.net, mm-hmm. it could be spelled with an E-R or an R-E, theater. We have directions up there, or also richardwasher.com. I have information up there that includes maps and times, and it's free of charge. No charge to come there.
Right.
We are participating with a fundraiser. Adventure Theater had a fire recently, so the Theater of Washington has started an initiative which we're participating in, asking people to help donate to help them recover from
that. That's a good cause.
Yeah, that's a great cause.
So, yeah, and you can reserve your seats. Not that there's assigned seating, but it's a great opportunity.
Yep.
Bring your imaginations and thinking caps and be ready to comment. So,
absolutely.
Wonderful. We'll see you next week. I'm looking forward to it.
I look forward to having you there. That's
great. Thanks again, Richard, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Please join us next week when we're going to have a pretty interesting conversation with a local visual artist whose name is David Carlson. He does a lot of different types of mixed media and different types of visual arts. So be sure to tune in then next Tuesday at 3. Again, I am Janet Copenhaver, Chair of Embracing Arlington Arts, and you are listening to WERA LP Arlington at 96.7 on your FM dial. I'm going to make another plug to please contact the County Board in support of Arlington Independent Media, which also is supporting WERA. So if you're listening, you're obviously a fan, so please send a letter in to the county board to not support any cuts or the drastic cuts that are being proposed. Thanks again for taking time out to listen today, and until next week, keep embracing Arlington Arts.